Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In a time of global pandemic, this summer's fire season, which is nearly upon us, poses new dire threats. Federal and state agencies have resurrected the obsolete policy of aggressively attacking all wildfires in all places in order to limit wildfire smoke. This fire policy from the 1930s was abandoned decades ago because it is ecologically harmful, economically unsustainable, and puts firefighters at unnecessary extra peril. The risk of the pandemic threatens crews with new dangers. An internal study by United States Forest Service scientists has determined that in a worst-case scenario, up to 10% of wildland firefighters could die this summer, with the number of deaths due to COVID-19 surpassing all other causes of firefighter fatalities. Today we talk with Timothy Inglesby, Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, about how the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic will play out with particular cruelty for wildland firefighters and how potential major pandemic disasters sweeping through fire camps could ultimately leave rural residents on their own. Tim, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're heading on to fire season, but I wonder, why is this fire season different perhaps than any other fire season that you've ever experienced?
Well, the short answer is the coronavirus crisis. It's completely upending how we even prepared for this fire season in the fire services. A lot of our early preseason meetings and trainings and preparations canceled. You know, I mean, it's upending their whole society in many ways. You know, there's no business as usual.
Well, I had a couple thoughts back in actually the beginning of the pandemic when I was thinking about the fire season that is impending every year. And there were two things that really concerned me. And one was people who are sometimes burnt out of their houses, usually not so badly in Oregon, but lots of times people have had to evacuate. Where do you evacuate when you have to shelter at home? That's the first question. And then what about the firefighters? So I want to talk first about the firefighters, and then I want to talk some later about the people who will be impacted by this fire season. So what are some of your biggest concerns about the safety and the health of firefighters in this season of pandemic?
Well, I really appreciate this concern about firefighters because I see them being kind of left out of the debate. There's a lot of concern that smoke will cause easier spread of the virus, or those who catch the virus have more severe illness. Amongst the general public, very few people thinking about what about those firefighters whose lungs are on the line. You know, they're right there. There's inherent health hazards and safety risk that comes with fighting fires, and you can mitigate them, you know, avoid them. You can't absolutely prevent them. And it just, you know, the hazards, you inhale a lot of smoke, a lot of soot, you're working long hours, exhausted, poor nutrition, sleep deprivation, all the natural, normal rigors of firefighting make firefighters even more vulnerable to catching the virus. Now, they'd be, you know, 20-somethings and think they're immortal. Not true, because their immune systems are severely taxed. I recall it took me months to recover from a firefighting season. I for years, I suffered chronic bronchitis every winter. And there would be weeks before I could even get the ability to taste or smell again. My lungs were just like a chimney of soot and smoke. So that's the concern about firefighters, is they're frontline responders. Very essential, but not expendable.
Well, actually, there's also a growing concern about young people and the fact that in Oregon now, I understand that, well, I guess nationally, 20% of all the new cases of COVID are people in their early 20s. And I know just walking down the street in my neighborhood, since people think the economy reopened, though it certainly hasn't here in Oregon, but I've seen all these clusters of young people hanging out and just trying to have a good time, or maybe having a good time after 3 or 4 months of being locked up. And then we see the next week the increase of cases on young people. I wonder if your sense of firefighters, who are mostly what, in their 20s and early 30s, if they think that they are as invulnerable to COVID and to any kind of possible near-death or death experience as the people that are hanging out in Southeast 13th in Selwood.
The typical young firefighter is very fit, and very strong and kind of, gung ho, gonzo, and may have that attitude that they are, impervious. That's the insidious thing about this virus, long incubation periods. And some people are contagious, but not symptomatic. And so, I do have concerns for the young firefighters, but here's an issue. Most of the senior leadership in fires, and particularly those who are on the what they call incident management teams, are older, like in their 50s or 60s or something. So they're very vulnerable. The crews they may be supervising may have the virus and not know it, or have mild symptoms when they catch it. But we could see, I hate to use the word decapitation of, senior leadership in the fire services with this pandemic.
Well, can you describe to us what the whole structure of the leadership and the followship in the firefighting teams are, and what it would be like to be living in a fire camp during fire season, and particularly if there's a really major burn?
The fire services use what's called the incident command system, and it's adopted by many emergency response, agencies and bureaucracies. It's kind of paramilitary style, hierarchical, top-down decision-making and all that. But it's also a large bureaucracy. And typically on large fires, they construct almost mini cities of hundreds of crews and all the logistical support teams and resources to support them. I recall on some fires with some of my crewmates, fire camp was the biggest town they'd ever lived in, because they were rural people, and with all that people and all that coming and going and commotion, it's probably the biggest risk to firefighters is not from flames on the front lines, but it's from the virus in the valley bottoms in these large fire camps.
Is there any way to do, some people are now calling physical distance, which I actually prefer to social distance. Is there any way to physical distance in a fire camp?
Well, that's what they're struggling to figure out, because, it depends on where the fire is located. You may be hard to find a large, wide level spot to house these people. Doing so may force them to locate fire camp far away from the actual fire. And there's a lot of commuting going on. That's the current plan. Let's just make these big fire camps even bigger to spread them out more. It's still, though, going to be very, very difficult to maintain social distancing in a large fire camp. And they're going to have to change. There's not going to be a large mess hall, for example, where your firefighters can come and mill about and eat. And the alternative is many smaller camps dispersed, and in which case you can locate them even closer to the fire lines. We call these spike camps, or even coyote camping. Crews kind of sleeping, bedding down near the fire line, and so it that way they can maintain social distancing as a crew from other crews.
So basically, it'd be the idea that this is your family. This is your household for the summer.
That's how they're organizing, yeah, like a household family unit in kind of modular level.
I'm not sure how that would work if you have a really big fire, but it sounds to me that that makes a lot more sense than having these mega camps, which would be really hard to control. And it sort of, in a way, feels like some of the discussions that are going on about whether schools should be open in the fall. So what are the pros and cons of either having these small camps, the coyote camps, or having the very large camps?
Well, the pros for the small camps is, again, you can locate them, closer to the fire. So you don't have an hour or 2 hour commute, these school buses, coming and going to the fire in the large fire camp. You can maintain social distancing from other crews. As a crew, you'll be be tight together, but you won't be mixing with other crews. That's a pro. And actually, that was my preference as a firefighter. I like to be camping in the forest, in the mountains, where it's quiet and you're in the environment. These large mini cities of huge fire camps, engines always going around, going off, and you can never sleep there.
It's like being in the hospital or something.
Yeah, they got all kinds of things, generators running constantly. The con part of that, though, is how do you service all, multiple dispersed camps, getting food, water, supplies, very challenging. So it pros and cons for both.
I wonder also, how do you coordinate all these small camps? It seems like there is, particularly, we should talk a bit more about what it's like when you're in the middle of fighting a fire, because it's very unpredictable. And it seems like you're constantly having shifting approaches and shifting commands to what you should do. So I just wonder how you would coordinate all that over all these people who are spaced out on these lovely woodland camps where they don't have cell phone service and you probably have a hard time communicating.
You know, that's I never had that experience. I was always out there on the line. And it is a wonder, these, the logistical people that, can coordinate all that. It's going to be much more challenging. And even then, ferrying in supplies to these camps is a potential vector of the virus. I guess people trust their Grubhub delivery driver, but, so that's a good question. How will they do that? And it's going to be very challenging.
Is this being talked about? Because when you raised these questions, I guess it was back in May when you wrote your report, was there any concern in the Forest Service to address all these serious health concerns that are before us as we're trying to deal with something that is normal, like a fire season?
Absolutely. There's concern from, bottom to top in the fire management community about this. The trouble is that, probably 80 different committees were tasked with coming up with policies and procedures, protocols. And, there's just no consensus. There's no consensus between the agriculture and interior agencies or even within Forest Service, different regions and such. No consensus. It kind of mirrors where we're at the federal government level. There's no real centralized, coordinated, science-based strategy for dealing with this. So it's another impact of really a failure leadership at the very top.
Well, I'm very concerned because, so far fire season hasn't started yet, though I guess we're still a few days away from when its official start. Isn't it like mid-July when it's actually supposed to start?
Well, for us in the Pacific Northwest, it has officially started, but it's, late coming. There's been big fires in the Southwest, in Arizona, for example, and they've had fires in Florida, in which case, and now the Great Basin's having, fires, and in which case some of the things they planned are not working so great. Like, in order to minimize packing in crews in vehicles, well, to maintain social distancing, we'll have more vehicles and have, fewer occupants. Well, that's very hard to find places, to park all these vehicles on these degrading Forest Service logging roads. And, if there were a blow up or something, we'd have traffic jams and possible, problems doing a quick evacuation of all those vehicles and all those crews. So, issues are arising as we're kind of testing out different mitigation, plans. But again, no, there's no coordination and no consensus. So even one region maybe really have great, a great plan and great procedures. They have no idea about the crews that they order from another region or another unit, another agency. Are they up to stuff? So it's very, very distressing.
Well, you listen to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Timothy Inglesby, who's Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, about how the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic will play out with particular cruelty for wildland firefighters this summer. What are your specific concerns about, besides inhaling smoke and that being really compromising of one's health, and particularly in terms of having any resilience towards COVID, what are some of the other concerns you have about the firefighters that are be facing the wildfires this summer?
Well, again, there's inherent health hazards, safety risk in fighting fires. And in response to try to limit smoke affecting the public, that what's happened is, the leadership of these agencies have resurrected what's called the 10 a.m. policy, attack all fires, total suppression. This is something that we had back in the 1930s. And is...
Wait, before you refer to the 10 a.m. policy, people don't probably know what that is. So what does that really mean?
Oh, 10 a.m. policy was the goal was to put out every fire in all places at all times by 10 a.m. the morning following its detection, and you know, put it out. And that was a goal. And, you know, we've amassed the world's greatest firefighting armada, you know, that accomplished that. We're still basically doing that in all but name. And, you know, we're able to get, you know, about 94 to 98% of all wildfires we're able to put out either before 10 a.m. the next morning or before 10 acres. Trouble is, it's those 2% that escape those efforts, grow very large, that, it, you know, cause the most problems in terms of spending, you know, and cost and smoke. And there's not much that we can humanly do about those 2% that are burning during conditions, particularly fueled by climate change. It's just not possible to stop and put out. Those big fires cause problems for people, but they're really what, you know, how these forests evolved, and they do good things for the land. So that's the quandary we're in, you know, to manage, to try to reduce smoke that's bad for people. We're suppressing, excluding fires, which are good for the land. So it's a quandary there.
Well, I think we learned the lessons about that in Portland, because until 2015, I'd never really experienced much smoke in the city, except when the Multnomah Falls burned, I think, in the early 90s. I remember there was smoke in town. But starting in 2015, we started getting a lot of smoke from Canada and Washington and California. And then in 2017, we had our own personal wildfire of 50,000 acres in Eagle Creek. And it was an interesting conundrum because everybody was complaining about the smoke. But at the same time that we were suffering that summer, and it was a really horrible summer to live through all that smoke, the next year when people went and looked at the forest, it looked like this was a good burn. So how do we balance between those two things, between having to endure smoke, and certainly in this time of COVID-19, it's very dangerous for people in cities and in wildland areas close to where the fires are burning to have to put up all the smoke. But at the same time, when fire is a necessary part of forest health, how do we reconcile that?
I know it's a paradox or a dilemma of trade-offs between two environmental goods: clean skies, healthy forest ecosystems. Sometimes the two don't coincide because most forests in our continent need fire. Fire is a vital role, but with fire comes smoke. And, you know, there are really very few fire-free forests, but there are no smoke-free fires. And so we have a dilemma. The problem is, though, in trying to limit smoke impacting communities and citizens, we're sending firefighters, young firefighters, to go and stick their lungs on the line and put out every fire in every place, even if it's doing good things for the land, even if it's, you know, the smoke impacts are minimal to communities. So that's a problem. And, you know, we're just living in the age of reckoning. And wildfire smoke, very visible. Everyone hates it. You can smell it, taste it. The invisible combustion emissions from fossil fuel burning, a much more dire threat to the planet and people, and we seem to tolerate that.
One of the few side benefits of this pandemic is that the environment, that the air is really cleared out because there's so fewer cars on the road. In the meantime, there's this other invisible thing, which is the virus, which is has us all by the neck, you know, threatening to undo us all. I think we're dealing with a whole bunch of really interesting contradictions right now. And I'm trying to figure out, how do we learn from this? How do we learn from the fact that getting cars off the road really does clean up the air so that we continue to either keep the cars off the road once the pandemic's over, or we start using vehicles that are actual zero emission vehicles? And I'm also thinking about how that integrates with how we look at fighting fires, wildfires.
I know. It's, you know, and we put out too many good fires because they emit smoke. And, you know, it's like, why is smoke singled out? I live in the Willamette Valley, the worst place on the planet for someone suffering from hay fever, okay? Pollen is a toxin to me, my health, and so many others. No one is saying, let's cut down all the trees, let's eliminate grass and all the other, you know, emitters of pollen to avoid that. How come we're saying let's extirpate fire from the landscape because it puts out smoke? it's kind of there's a contradiction there.
I had Catherine Thomason with Physicians for Social Responsibility on a few weeks ago, and she was talking about ways that the state should be stepping in to mitigate the effects of smoke, particularly on marginalized communities, older people, communities of color, et cetera. And it seems that smoke is something that if we were organized well as a society, we could protect people from the smoke. It means you have to stay inside, and it means there's some trade-offs, but ultimately, it seems that if people were set up to be able to expect to have smoke for a certain part of the summer and live with it and be protected by financing that be provided by the government, that we could have the fires burn in the forest in a much more healthy regime.
Absolutely. And I totally agree, because we know how to protect people and, you know, in buildings from air pollution. But, you know, we don't know how to eliminate wildfires and their smoke from the landscape. We've tried. Oh, we have tried for the last century. And fortunately, we failed, because our forest, our ecosystems, the planet would be very different were we to succeed in extirpating and extinguishing all fires from the landscape. So again, smoke is something we have to deal with. What young firefighters are being asked to kind of sacrifice, you know, their health and safety, and really kind of a futile attempt, because there will be that 2% of the fires that, despite their best efforts, will go. You know, there was a fire in the Willamette National Forest. One lightning bust sparked 30 fires, the Tumblebug Fire, and I can't recall the year. And they sent crews to chase all 30 fires, and they got all of them put out but three. And those three spread to include the entire area with all those ignitions, 30,000 acres or more burned. And, you know, had they been intelligent and wise, said, okay, let's just draw a big circle around all these little fires. And they're actually doing good stuff for the ground. Yeah, it's smoky, but, you know, this is doing a lot of fuels reduction for free and not putting people and the firefighters' health at risk. But, you know, that's a concern, though, is if the fire world knows this is not good policy, going back to this obsolete 10 a.m. attack all fires policy. They're thinking it's just a short term, you know, just this year, try to keep smoke emissions as low as possible, and then we can get back to a saner, more scientifically sound policy. But that slippery slope can be a free fall. Next year, I fully expect we'll have the coronavirus still on the planet. Next year, we'll have wildfires burning. We're going to have climate change making them more active. You know, when do we really make the shift? So that's what some firefighters are talking about, is instead of like temporary changes just to limp through this season, let's make the big changes we've known we need to make for decades in really being more selective and strategic. What are the wildfires we really need to fight? And those are the ones that threaten homes and communities. There's where we reserve our crews' health and energy, put them where it counts, not out in the middle of some wilderness area. 2 days ago, a firefighter was killed. Hundreds of crews in the middle of a wilderness area, sparsely vegetated, flat terrain, died to keep smoke from going, you know, dozens of miles away. And it was, you know, right now today, we're experiencing smoke from Siberian wildfires. They don't care about our 10 a.m. policy.
Well, it seems that if we were to switch gears back to where we were supposed to have been before this year and really be selective about which fires we put out and allow small fires to burn, how would that impact the threat of higher severity fires?
Well, by allowing more fires to burn, it would whittle down some of that dead down material that accumulates every year, needles, limbs, and, you know, kind of reduce the prospects of really, you know, high intensity fires burning in that ground. But, you know, high severity fires are also a natural phenomenon, especially here in our big tree bioregion, the Pacific Northwest. And they're a critical habitat for some species. So, oddly, it's when there's you know, stable air, we're called air inversions, that keeps flame lengths really low. They kind of creep and smolder. Those would produce the most smoke. it's when the air is unstable and it's rising. You get high flame lengths, but the air goes up, up, and away. And so, again, it's a paradox, you know. And so, you know, low-intensity fires can be very, very smoky. And high-intensity fires produce a large smoke column that goes up to 30,000 feet and, you know, falls as rain down in somewhere in Kansas, okay?
I think it was some high-intensity fires that we were getting a couple years ago when we had all that smoke coming from BC. And there were 600 fires burning, and some of them were small, but some of them were pretty big. So it seems like Vancouver had even worse air than we had in it 2 years ago.
Oh, yes, yeah, Seattle was horrible, you know, from the BC fires. It's a global phenomenon. Again, we're living in the age of climate change is, you know, the bill is being is due for our excessive burning of dead carbon. We can't really eliminate smoke from the planet, but we can filter it out from our homes, businesses, communities. You can care for people that are especially sensitive to smoke. Then that we know how to do, and we can do, and must do.
Well, one of the things that's really frustrating, you kind of mentioned it a little while ago, there's all these sensible things that we could do, but there's the lack of leadership to do them. And one of them is this concern that Physicians for Social Responsibility raised about providing adequate, meaningful smoke mitigation for all kinds of communities across the state that do not have the means to have air conditioning or to have air filters in their house. It's basically provide air filters and also to provide smoke refuge centers. It also becomes harder. Everything's harder right now because of COVID. And so how do you envision that we get that leadership kicked in gear? And I think Kate Brown is doing a pretty good job right now of trying to herd a lot of cats around Salem and throughout the state. But how do we get some really forceful leadership to make inroads so that as the smoke season and the fire season really gets going, we have some kind of respite for people?
You know, it's hard for me to fathom how to do that without regime change, starting with the federal government. And I think that attitude is widely shared. Like, you know, we could talk about some good ideas for change, but it's just not going to happen until we, you know, have this regime change. And even then, promises, but the next administration, we're going to have to push to make some changes that are going to rankle, you know, some very vested interest in the status quo. You know, the thing is, you know, even firefighting is very difficult on the line to maintain social distancing. And so, you know, there are going to be, you know, some crews sacrificed. They have more to fear perhaps from each other than the flames itself in terms of spreading infection and getting ill. And even if they don't die, they could be, you know, I mean, we're finding that out. People are very sick, very long time, sometimes permanent damage. So I really am concerned about that. But the thing is, where you can't maintain social distancing in the heat of battle, state of emergency, fighting fire, we can do that long before the first whiff of smoke. So what should be happening? These young people should be put to work helping prepare homes and communities to be, you know, not so ignition prone, and, you know, proactively dealing with lawnscaping, chucking the firewood out from underneath their deck, you know, things that are often firefighters are called to do when fire is encroaching. That should have been done long before the first whiff of smoke. So there we can maintain social distancing. We can disperse people throughout the community. I look forward to the possibilities of a Green New Deal to do the kind of work needed that, you know, in a partnership really between agencies and communities together to figure this out. But get out from under this crisis management mode, state of emergency panic, and just start being, you know, more intelligent and more proactive in relearning how to live with fire on the land.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Timothy Inglesby, who's Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, about how the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic will play out with particular cruelty for wildland firefighters this summer. And we're talking about some of the solutions to this problem, which we probably aren't going to be able to address this summer. So I'm feeling like what we have ahead of us for the next few months could be like several months of real misery, particularly for firefighters. Is there anything, do you think there's time to do the kinds of fire protection, fireproofing of homes in the wildland urban interface and other things you're describing before it's too late this year?
Well, you know, it's never too late. It's like it's never too late to be prepared for the big earthquake in the Northwest. And what an ideal time when many people are kind of at home all day, you know, get out there and start pruning your shrubs and sweeping your roof and doing the other things that are necessary. But it's never too late. I think we're going to have to make it through this season best we can. What is going to happen, though, is we're going to have so much fire going that we're going to have to triage. And you know, even though the leaders are saying attack all fires everywhere all at once, my concern is that, you know, they're doing that right now and they're going to be exhausted or many of them ill. And for each ill crew member wipes out the rest of that crew for quarantine, where will they be in August when our fire season peaks? September or October in Southern California peaks? Yeah, we have to start being very judicious, very selective and strategic. Where do we put firefighters at risk? Where do we tax their health and immune systems now? Because we'll need them for a long haul. We could see collapse. I mean, that's scuttlebutt about some epidemiologists running their models. You know, we could, you know, literally crews decimated, one out of every 10 coming down with illness, taking out that whole crew. And that's happening, you know, it's...
So that's already happening now in some of the fires that are being fought in drier places?
It has in California with the inmate crews, which Cal Fire, their state fire department, about half their hand crews come from inmate crews. And the pandemic swept through the prison system. And I think they have, you know, the numbers escape me. Barely a third of the crews are available right now because the rest have been, or, you know, quarantined. And it's very typical. Every crew available is out there on the line in California, in particular. Well, they've only got one third of the crews available. It's only July. And so it's already happening in places like California that firefighters are dropping out. Whole crews are, you know, offline.
Well, you mentioned in your report that there's a good possibility that more firefighters in wildland fires this summer will die from COVID than will die from other firefighting fatalities. Kind of reminds me of a statistic I learned about the 1918 flu pandemic, that more American soldiers died from the flu than died in World War I, which was fighting at the same time. I wonder if you see any kind of parallels or analogies there.
Well, that's very thought-provoking. Yeah, I mean, people typically think that the biggest risk to firefighters is being burned up. And they face so much more risk from traffic accidents, driving on these very, you know, sketchy, abandoned logging roads in smoky, dusty conditions with sleep deprivation and exhaustion. Traffic accidents, a major fatality. Aircraft accidents, that's another plan. Oh, we'll just send more aircraft to fight fires, and that, so we can't put hand crews at risk. That just shifts the risk to aircraft. And, you know, that was a helicopter firefighter pilot who died 2 days ago. You know, bee stings and all kinds of things heart attacks. You know, there's all kinds of health hazards and safety risks. It's inherent. You can mitigate it. You can avoid it. Firefighter safety is a number one value, but firefighter health should also be a number one value.
Well, you mentioned how firefighters are deemed essential workers, and which puts them in the same category with a lot of other essential workers that are being really kind of overlooked. What does it mean to you to be an essential worker, and what do you expect from society and from the government to support you as an essential worker?
Well, if you're an essential worker, frontline worker, first responder, if you're out there serving the rest of the community and society, you should be supported. And one thing that we're wildland firefighters, the majority of which are seasonal workers, they only work summers, they're off in the winters, and they're off on their own. They are not supportive for their health care. Now, right now, the federal government's promise, if you get COVID-19, we'll be there for you. Well, that's not true. The Department of Labor is denying claims for medical support because you can't prove that you got this on the job. So, promises, promises. Well, after during the winter, there's no health care for seasonal wildland firefighters, and it's not uncommon for men to just go naked, okay? Have no health insurance. So I believe our society, we need a national health care system, that it covers everybody, high quality, low cost, everybody. And until we get that, many of our essential frontline workers are very vulnerable, especially firefighters. They will be recovering through the winter. They will be most vulnerable, perhaps, catching COVID in the winters after they've maxed out their lungs and their immune systems, and they'll have no medical support. So that should be the first obligation for society. Fully support your frontline workers, your essential workers. They're not expendable. That's a very bad attitude. I really shudder to think that some people think that.
Well, another thing makes me think about the shortage of personal protective equipment. And I just was at the dentist today, and my dentist office is really fully equipped, but they didn't open till today because it took them that long to get the equipment they needed to protect them and their patients. I'm wondering what kind of protection firefighters have and if they need extra protection to be fighting fires in the midst of a pandemic.
Well, that's a tough one, because you really cannot work with a mask on. Yeah, you super heat up, you're breathing your own. It doesn't work. You need as fresh air as you can get. One way they can be protected, though, is with rigorous screening and testing. And that's, not happening. There's still problems with that, because just simple screening, ask it a questionnaire. You could report, no, I have no symptoms, and you still may be infected. You didn't know it. Testing, of course, should be systematic and frequent. That's one way to protect, because when you do encounter a person who has been infected, isolate them immediately. But in terms of personal protection equipment, hand sanitizers and that kind of stuff. But
that's flammable, actually. It's probably not a good thing to be using.
Yeah. But, that's a tough one. As is social distancing, is a very challenging thing to pull off in a practical way in firefighting.
I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done in the next few weeks to at least move in a direction. Is there any way for communities to support wildland firefighters, or is there any kind of campaign to contact elected officials on the state or the federal level to try to move quickly to do at least create some of these precautions?
Well, there's a couple things. Number one, there's a bill been introduced in Congress to provide wildland firefighters with health care if they get COVID, and just assume you got it on the job, you're covered. Workers' compensation just should, no questions asked, do that. So that's been introduced by Democrats in the Senate and will probably go the way of the Grim Reaper, Senator McConnell, and never come to a vote. But, that's one way. But probably the biggest way is the public to just get real, lower their expectations. In case of a wildfire, don't expect a fire engine parked in your driveway. Don't expect a crew, defending your home. Don't expect that fire to be put out immediately and reduce smoke. We need to be kind of realistic in our human capacities and mindful that, again, this is another symptom of climate change and all that firefighting of the past and all the clear cutting and grazing and all these land uses and abuses of the past, we're paying the price now. And so if this is a moment for a whole society to really fundamentally change, go for a big change, now's the time.
Well, while I was putting together the webpage for the show and I was going through some photographs of the campfire in Paradise, California a couple of years ago, and it was really chilling because I was actually looking for pictures of woodland on fire, and it was all houses on fire. And it really made me think about what we're facing. And it also makes me think of some of the problems with communities like Paradise, which were built like these suburban tracks at the edge of forests. Because the other thing about the campfire was that it burnt down paradise in just a matter of hours, despite the fact that there were fire engines in people's driveways or for moments before they all scattered. So what are those kind of lessons that we can learn for what we're going to be facing this summer?
That's very excellent, that observation. The dominant image of wildfire is an urban fire. Incinerated homes, charred ruins of, neighborhoods. That's not a wildfire. Wildfire is in wild land. That is an urban fire. Now, it started as a wildfire, but it became an urban fire. Again, we do not know how to fireproof forests. We have a pretty good idea how to fireproof buildings. And that we can do. We have the technology, the knowledge. We just lack the willpower, basically, to do that. So that's where we should concentrate, firefighting and suppressing fires is to prevent homes and communities from burning, because that is absolutely toxic smoke. Paradise was a hazard, was a hazmat site for months. Air, water, terrible. What's happening up there in the wilderness in roadless wildlands, the forest smoke, a very different matter, and the effects there are generally very positive, very beneficial to the land and all it provides us. Tolerate that smoke so we can save our crews and concentrate on the kind of smoke you don't want to see, can't see, and that's burning homes and communities.
I don't want to be a smug Oregonian, but I look at all the communities in California and in Arizona and other places around Colorado that are burnt down, that are like these suburban communities at the edge of forests. I can't think of anything as quite equivalent as ever happened in Oregon. And I think it's because of our land use laws that we don't have paradises happening. Though some of my friends were afraid Portland was going to be one of those cities in 2017.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I can't recall that either, which doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but it seems almost every year Sisters, Oregon is threatened by fires. Southwestern Oregon, a lot of dispersed homes in the rural areas, they're threatened by fires. It's we developed these rural homes and communities, neighborhoods, during a time when we had kind of cool, moist climate conditions. We had this giant army of firefighters and all their machines, put them out, and it kind of led us into a false sense of security. At the same time, Smokey Bear is telling us to fear all fires, fight all fires, and so now we're kind of the double whammy here. Is we've built homes in many indefensible places, and are living them in indefensible ways, so we're going to have to rethink that. Now we can't, just depopulate rural areas. Not every person who lives in rural America is, is a rich person in a McMansion. There's a lot of poverty in rural America, and they especially could use some kind of assistance, with a Green New Deal and federal crews, particularly putting young people. Rural communities are hemorrhaging their youth because there's no jobs, there's no opportunities. They're flocking to Portland, okay, where they go to retire at 20 something, right? They could be doing a lot of righteous, good labor, good community service, helping prepare homes and communities to live with fire. And that's really what could be done, should be done. And I look forward to perhaps, like, again, regime change, paradigm shift. To see that happen.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Tim Inglesby, who's the Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. And we're talking about the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on this season's firefighting. Well, I want to get back to the plight of the wildland firefighters. You mentioned that 1 in 10 firefighters might be infected with COVID this summer. Where does that figure come from, by the way?
That was a model, a study done by some people in the fire lab in Missoula, kind of an early run epidemiological study. And it did cause some alarm, and it got some scientists in a little minor trouble, like, how dare you release that bad news when at the top, we just want happy news, right? Life's going back to normal. We're making America great again. But 1 in 10 being infected or ill, again, puts, one out of a 20-person crew puts the whole 20-person crew offline. So this ripple effects becomes a tidal wave of loss of crews. And that's, again, the nature of this pandemic. It is kind of a geometric exponential rate of spread. And so there's a lot of concerns. We could rapidly outpace our capacity to deal with it.
When you say that the entire crew has to be quarantined, what happens to them? Are they taken off the site and go home for 2 weeks or?
A very good question. For 14 days, they've got to hang out. I mean, when they set up fire camps, they probably should plan for, isolation places, a separate fire camp, to house these people or put them up in hotels or, I mean, you don't want to send them home because then they're along the way, they're infecting anyone they encounter. So, yeah, a lot of these things are very difficult to think through. So, again, I think the plan is let go of this pretense that we can attack all fires and put them out and have clean skies and no illness. Be very selective and strategic. What are the fires we must fight? What are the fires that we can manage? And how can we prepare people to deal with it and keep young people, their health and safety, cared for?
Well, this might be a little bit out of your area of expertise, but I also have been really concerned all spring and now summer about people who are living in the line of fire this summer and what happens to people who are forced to evacuate.
Yeah, well, I think there's problems with that model. When a fire's nearby, the first thing is evacuate the labor force, okay? And with the expectation that, government crews alone can put out the fire. We're going to have to get to that place where, those who need to be evacuated, find safe shelter for them, but able-bodied citizens, with the proper training and equipment can work, alongside, agency experts and supervisors to care for the communities. Because often what burns a house is not this giant tsunami of flame, but it's the tiniest little ember that lands on your roof you could put out with a garden hose. It's a fire creeping along the needles of your lawn that marches up to your doorstep. You could stop with a leaf rake, okay? In Australia, they have this model because they're so dispersed. They don't have a giant federal firefighting. I mean, they call it prepare, leave early, or stay and defend. And you don't want to leave late. They realize they cannot count on the government to come save them, protect them, and be as successful with that.
Well, one concern is though, yeah, we have these images of people when they are evacuating from fire or from any other natural disaster. They wind up in school gymnasiums or in churches. That's not going to work this summer. So what is going to happen to these people who have to leave their homes?
That's very true. Yeah, it may not be able to house them all cramped in a school gymnasium. They may have to spread them out in a Walmart parking lot, which was what happened in Paradise, tragically. But yeah, that's the thing. So again, we need a paradigm shift. We stop planning for reacting to wildfires as an emergency. We start being proactive, preparing for fires. We know they're inevitable. They're necessary. And they're unavoidable. So, rather than changing the nature of the planet, we can change a little bit of our behavior. Not to be alarmist, but I do fear it by the end of this summer, there could be rural communities very vulnerable. We will not have the firefighting capacity. They will be on their own. What are they going to do? And so now is the time to start thinking. It's citizens and communities that got to start thinking about this, not just the fire services. And I bet put to a vote, okay, where would you rather, put that crew's health and safety at risk? On a mountaintop in the middle of a wilderness area that, needs to burn, or near your home? Would put to a vote, where do you think they would choose? Okay.
Since we're talking by Zoom, I'm getting a look at the wall behind your head, and I see Smokey the Bear. And he's between two posters. That's the Wildland Fire book, right, that you did with some other people? Okay, right. So what is the significance of Smokey the Bear between these two posters that are about basically celebrating the need for fire in the forest?
Well, my poster is Smokey Bear, point his finger, right, directly at what says only you. And I take that message very to heart. Only you, only us can really change the paradigm that is dictating we attack all fires. And you know, fighting fires essentially is making war on nature. And you know, we're damned if we lose, but we're also damned if we win. We'll just have a very different planet, not sustainable for the great biodiversity of life that really thrives with fire. So only we can change the paradigm, learn to live with fire, learn how to work with fire, as we've known as a species since time immemorial. Somehow we forgot that the past century or so. And so Smokey is really appealing. I mean, his eyes are begging us. Only we can strip these blue jeans off his bare butt, set him free to go back to the wild where real bears love burns. That's where you got the big logs full of grubs and the healthy salmon and berries that thrive with fire. Real bears love burns. Cartoon bears in pants are just that, a cartoon. So how is it that our society is letting our fire policy be dictated by a cartoon bear? You got me.
Well, Tim, it's great to talk with you. And I hope in the next year that some of your vision comes true. What are your hopes in the last moment? What are you hoping will be different maybe when we talk next fire season?
There is so much righteous good work in the woods to be done, especially for young people, preparing the ground to live with fire, preparing homes, communities to live with fire. So I look really forward to a Green New Deal, providing the means for getting young people start out life, you know, with the right foot, doing really good work that will be part of a sustainable future.
Well, Tim, thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Today, we've been talking with Timothy Inglesby, Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times, if you're able, by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the Donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Matthews, author of Trees in Trouble. I'm Robert Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
Long distance runner, what you standing there for? Get up, get out, get out of the door. You're playing cold music on the ballroom floor, drowned in your laughter and dead to the core. There's a dragon with matches loose on the town. It takes a whole pail of water just to cool him down. Fire, fire on the mountain. Fire, fire on the mountain. Oh, fire. fire on the mountain. Fire, fire on the mountain.
You really